Hello,
Oh, good morning.
everybody. All right, mate.
I'm doing good. How are you feeling, Andy?
All right. Coughing and spluttering, but okay.
You've sounded better, but if part of do you have a synopsis if Andy wants to just sort of hang back and just do commentary or whatever?
I just assumed that I was going to grab the battle line synopsis.
Okay.
Since we don't actually write our own, it's real easy.
Yeah. Yeah,
Yeah,
I definitely
sorry
prefer it.
about
Oh, not at all, Andy.
But if I had to
excuse me.
make that the opener.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Nerys.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
You're the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. For Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander. The journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
We've lost all contact with the space station.
What the hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the prophets. A Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation with Sean Engel and Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
Hey everybody, and welcome to yet another episode of Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine show in which we are going episode by episode through the most underrated of Star Trek series. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am joined by my two faithful companions, as always, Mr. Sean Engel.
Hey everyone, how's it going today?
And my hurting friend, Mr. Andy Leyland.
Everybody.
As you can tell, Andy's a little under the weather, so I'm sure his insights will remain as keen as ever, but you may have a little bit more trouble understanding his words.
That to be most of the time.
Well, with all these episodes of Hey Kids Comics, we've gotten used to the funny accent. It's the sickness now that we're having to deal with that's causing the problems.
I hear you guys say this all the time. You have the funny accent. Mine is perfectly normal.
That's you keep on believing that, sir. Keep on believing.
Yeah, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, Sean talks almost like a normal person.
That's very disturbing because living here in Oklahoma, you would expect me to have the very twangy, I don't want to say rednecky, but the very southern accent. And I just, for some reason, I never really developed that. So I'm kind of glad that my voice is just a sort of generic voice.
Yeah. Were you born and raised there, or
I was born in Kansas, but I've lived pretty much most of my life here in Oklahoma. So I never really picked up any type of specific accent. So there you go.
Yeah, if you came here to New York and you took up residence, I don't think people would like say, "Hey, where's that guy from? He's got a strange accent." I don't think they'd notice you at all.
Oh, that's very nice of you to
say
that.
We're talking about voice
you.
Timbre here.
It was very nice for you to say that, Paul. I like to think I'd fit right in New York.
You, I think they might notice that you were not a native.
Yeah, but New York wouldn't care, would they?
Well, no. I mean, it wouldn't, I don't think they'd make a big deal over it. But you'd if you came to New York for any extended period of time, you'd fall into doing your Clint Eastwood voice, which please don't do it now while you're sick. But you'd...
Do I not sound like I'm doing it anyway?
There's a little bit of it coming out. But I think you'd do that and then people wouldn't notice you either.
See, the one thing that I have the problem with, and I noticed this when I was down in for Star Wars Celebration, and I spent the, Hair Metal Hero and I, shacked up in a room together to save some money. And after a while, listening to his Bostonian accent, I sort of did a Zelig, and occasionally I'd be peppering my speech with the sort of Bostonian accent, I'd get to the car and stuff like that, and dropping my R's. So maybe it's just the fact that I get that kind of Zelig type feel that I sort of assimilate accents, and because I've never really assimilated, I never really hung out with people who had a specific Southern accent, I never assimilated that. So maybe that's it. But this isn't a show. This isn't a show about different dialects. This is a show about Star Trek.
Right.
Just from a Star Trek kind of a convoluted point of view. Sitting last night and watching Wrath of Khan, which was being broadcast on BBC America.
An apt place for it to be shown, I think you'll agree.
And that was exactly what I was going to say. My thought of BBC America is we should be receiving shows from the United Kingdom that we don't get here. It seems weird that we should be getting, we should be getting The Wrath of Khan and very frequently Star Trek The Next Generation.
Why are you not getting great stuff like Broadchurch and Secret Smile and all these other great things David Tennant's done that isn't Doctor Who?
We actually did. They did. I do Broadchurch up here. They ran, I think it was like, six or eight episodes? And they ran like the first series, I think, of it. And I think they're...
Yeah, I think it is.
See, and I think... I'm not certain. I think Fox Network is picking it up as well, but they're... They may have changed the name to Grace Point and may have just repurposed it because it looks like essentially like the same plot that was on Broadchurch.
Oh, no, you've refilmed it.
Oh, we have? Okay.
Yes, you've refilmed it, and David Tennant's in it with an American accent.
Oh, okay.
Which I cannot for the life of me understand. Just show Broadchurch, for God's sake.
Well, it's maybe
there
it's...
is an entire world out there that doesn't speak with an American accent, and most Americans can understand other accents.
Yeah, well, maybe it's
stop,
just
please.
Maybe it's like that. Maybe it's like, you know, when they did Life on Mars and made the American version that was...
No, just show the British one!
Yes, because I heard the British one was significantly better than the American one.
The British one's brilliant, and so's Ashes to Ashes, the sequel.
But tangents, we need to get back on Star Trek. Do we have some Star Trek news this time out?
That was my Star Trek news. I was watching Wrath of Khan last night.
Okay. Oh, on BBC.
But also, but I do find BBC America. I'm also watching a lot of Star Trek The Next Generation on there, so it just always strikes me as weird.
Well, Star Trek The Next Generation kind of works more simply because they've got Patrick Stewart behind it. And, I think Patrick Stewart definitely has that very sophisticated British feel. And plus, he's Sir Patrick Stewart, so he's a KOB? What do they call it, Andy?
Is he an MBA or is he an OBA?
Okay, MBA, yeah. Or,
is he...
Yeah. The Order of the British Empire, yeah. He's an actual knight.
He's something like that, yeah.
Alright, well that's it. That's my Star Trek news. I'm done.
Right, the only other thing we've got is Sean mentioned before we started recording, Roberto Orci has been replaced as director of the upcoming Star Trek 3, and Jonathan Frakes has said, hey, I'll do it! Which I think's a good idea. What do you think?
Despite some of the criticism I've heard, I like Star Trek First Contact a lot. A lot. I mean, not even just a little bit. I like it a lot. And that was his, I guess, his feature film directorial debut. Insurrection, I have a little bit more of a problem with, but most of my problem with Insurrection is in the story, not in the directing. So I think he understands how to put together a Star Trek movie. And I really would have no problem at all with him taking over as the director on this, and I would hope that he would have a little bit of creative control in it as well. This is the first I actually heard that he had thrown his hat in the ring, but I'm on board for it as a first thought.
No, I was just going to say, he's directed everything that's pretty much on the air at the minute. Leverage, Castle, Burn Notice, he's done all of them, and his episodes are always interesting visually. I think he's grown in, and let's not forget, he directed many, many episodes of all the Star
Trek shows.
So I've got no problem with it. And I think Paul has inadvertently hit the nail on the head in that I don't think the current creative types would be willing to defer creative control to anyone else. They seem to think they're doing an excellent job with it.
Yeah, I wouldn't be opposed to Frakes directing. My big concern would be who's going to be writing the screenplay, because
still Orci, I think.
I thought Orci was out. He was.
No, he's only been shown the door as director. The report, unless you've read a different report to me, which is possible. The one I read said that Paramount weren't willing to risk the big tentpole picture for that year on a novice director.
See, because I'd heard initially when J.J. Abrams moved out and and went over to do Star Wars, that Orsi dropped the writing role and moved on to do the directing. And maybe Abrams will be in to do, like, executive producer or whatever. Maybe the bad robot will be there to be sort of funding the show. But Orsi and Kurtzman were out in writing, and Orsi was in directing. And now that he's out of directing, I think they get a good director in, like Jonathan Frakes. I think that'd be great. But I think the primary thing is someone who has a knowledge of writing Star Trek stories, a knowledge of writing something that's not a big action set piece, something that has a bit more meat to it. And if they find someone who can do that, then I think the next Star Trek movie will be significantly better than Into Darkness, or even, you know, the first new Trek movie, which, again, we've said isn't necessarily bad, but it's not Star Trek. They need someone in there to write a Star Trek movie. Not only did they mention that Jonathan Frakes was throwing his hat into the ring, but they also mentioned a couple of other directors that I thought would be kind of interesting to take over for Orsi. One of them was Joe Cornish, the guy who did Attack the Block and was the co-writer for The Adventures of Tintin, and he was also wrote Hot Fuzz along with Edgar Wright.
Well, he's also one half of Adam and Joe, which I presume you never got.
No.
See, that would be perfect for BBC America. It was this really low-budget comedy show between these two loafers in the bedroom, Adam Buxton and Joe Cornish. And basically, they did skits with Star Wars action figures before anyone else was doing Star Wars stuff. It's a good 15 years ago now they were doing this. They were straight out of high school when they were doing it. And they were doing piss takes of Star Wars with their action figures, and it was really funny. Hmm. And both of them have launched a career on the back of that show. Adam Buxton, he's in Hot Fuzz. He's the journalist who gets speared through the head.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. I know exactly who that is then.
So Joe Cornish...
They essentially did Robot Chicken before Robot Chicken, is what you're saying?
Essentially, yes. They were doing Robot Chicken before Robot Chicken. Yeah, brilliantly put. Well done.
And the other person that I mentioned that goes along with Joe Cornish was they mentioned possibly getting Edgar Wright in to direct it. Now,
I don't think so. I think Edgar Wright's too much of a visionary in his own right.
Yeah.
He's already proved he doesn't want to work within the Marvel system. Whatever went down, whatever story you want to believe. And I don't think there's a bad guy in that story. Edgar Wright certainly doesn't seem to blame Marvel for what they did. Kevin Feige certainly doesn't seem to blame Edgar Wright for what went down.
Yeah,
they wanted to do something. Edgar didn't want to do that. They parted ways. But I think that's symptomatic of Edgar Wright, is one of those directors who has a very specific way of doing things. And that's great because it leads to great films. But I think if we try and pigeonhole him into the Star Trek, it's not going to work. Joe Cornish could probably do a good job.
Yeah, that was kind of my thought as well. I think Wright is far too visionary. And plus, I feel that Wright probably has more of an affinity for the Star Wars. I could see him doing one of the little Star Wars spin-off movies, but specifically pinning him to Star Trek, I think it probably wouldn't work. But yeah, I'd be more than happy to see Joe Cornish did it. I loved Attack of the Block. I thought that was a fun movie. It had some great character pieces. And, you know, he obviously, you know, has a love for sci-fi. So let's, you know, either that or Frakes, you know, I think would be interesting. But my one concern is they need to get a writer who would write a script that feels like Star Trek.
Yeah, I'd like to see them just, you know, they can do a lot of what they've already done. I think for today's audience, trying to get a young audience, I don't disagree with the idea that you want to have some, you know, decent action sequences in there. But just, you know, give us a little bit more of a science fiction-y concept. And build around that, and build your action sequences around that science fiction concept. And I think we're okay.
Well, I think Simon Pegg has also poo-pooed Edgar Wright being involved with it, because the two of them don't just be want to seen as a duo all the time.
Mm-hmm. You know, because they basically worked since Spaced, essentially, together.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Cornetto trilogy and, you know, all that. So, having him come on to work Star Trek would probably just make people think, oh, it's going to be another Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz type reunion. And Star Trek doesn't need to be that. Star Trek needs to be Star Trek.
I do wonder if Simon Pegg's going to say anything nasty about the new Star Wars movies.
I don't know. Do you think that Pegg would have, you know, something to say about Abrams, since Abrams left? Because Pegg was from what I remember, Peg was actually trying to be as diplomatic with the new with the Into Darkness thing and the kind of debacle about it. I know he kind of went off when people rated Into Darkness as the worst Star Trek film of the franchise.
Well, if you actually read what he said, as opposed to the clickbait headline, he didn't actually tell fans to fuck off. What he said was, it is not the worst Star Trek movie, fuck off. He just said it as a statement. And they twisted that to be the headline, Peg tells Star Trek fans to, you know, I've said it twice now, so we're over a 15 rating hour. So he didn't actually tell fans what the report said he said. If you read the exact quote, well, I mean, we say that as like punctuation, no, you're wrong, that fuck off, kind of thing. And that's the way he said it. I don't know that Into Darkness is the worst Star Trek film. It's certainly not the best, but he was quoted out of context. But J.J. Abrams also produces the Mission Impossible movies, so Peg's got a vested interest in not dissing his boss, because he's in them as well.
But you know what? I can understand as an actor on a show, a series of movies, or actually an actor in any movie, or anybody who has anything to do with any movie, how you could get very, very frustrated with the internet flare-ups that occur.
Look at the fuss over the 88 seconds of Star Wars.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. That trailer shows you nothing, yet people have managed to rant and rave about it as if it was the second coming.
Yeah, I don't get that. I really don't. I mean, I think people have to learn to just sit back a little bit more. Now, sometimes there's enough information revealed that I think you start to be able to form a little bit of an opinion, but I think you still have to keep an open mind that opinion could be wrong. That's been my experience with the new Fantastic Four movie. Every bit of information that comes out about that seems to make it worse.
That's exactly where I was just going to go, Paul. It was, you can get enough information about a movie or maybe see a clip or whatever to know that that's not for you. And I've got your back there. Everything they released about that Fantastic Four movie, irrespective of who they've cast in it, just makes me go, I'm not interested in this film. Before you even get to the cast, I'm not interested in the film.
Yeah, but you know what? If the movie comes out and it comes out to rave reviews from people who I trust, I'm going to give it a shot. On the other hand, if everything is as I expect it to be, I probably will see it when it's on like the USA channel or something like that.
I think the thing with that one is, if you go into it not wanting it to be a Fantastic Four movie, it may end up being quite a good film.
Yeah, that's possible, but I want a Fantastic Four movie.
Well, exactly.
That's kind of what we got with, or if you lowered your expectations for Into Darkness, if you didn't expect it to be a Star Trek film, it's not a bad film. There are some enjoyable moments in it, but if you go in there expecting a Star Trek film, then you're probably going to be somewhat disappointed, because yes, all the trappings of Star Trek are there, but the feel, the story is not.
Yeah, there's little nitpicky things, and I got to be sensitive in how I say this, but like,
just say it.
Yeah, the fact that they cast an African American man to play Johnny Storm, I don't care. I really don't. I think Iris Allen as an African American woman on The Flash is great. Mm-hmm. She plays the part well. She fits the character. It's fine. I don't really care if they go black, white, Asian, whatever, if it's not something that's totally into the character. In this particular instance, there's nothing that says that Johnny Storm has to be a Caucasian man, but there is something that says he's there with his sister, and I think if he's going to be an African-American man, she should be an African-American woman. Don't give me this bullshit that she's adopted and all that. They're the same parents. They're born together. You want to cast black actors? I'm okay with that. But do both of them. Don't change everything. Don't change things fundamentally. Let's not make Dr. Doom an internet blogger, you know? more problem with that than I have with an African American man being cast.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Before you even get to the casting, there are so many things about this project that sound boneheaded. Do you know what it reeks of? It reeks of, we own the rights to this. We do not want Marvel to get the rights back to this. Let's make this as cheaply as possible.
Isn't that what they essentially did with the Corman version?
Yeah, it sounds exactly like a rerun of what happened with the Corman version.
I'm not sure about that so much as I'm thinking along the lines of, we have the rights to this, we don't want Marvel to get the rights back to it, we have to make a movie, let's just make the movie we want to make, and who gives a shit if it's the Fantastic Four, really? We're going to call it that, but we're not going to actually go to make it that.
You don't think they're just sort of salting the earth behind it to just basically say, hey, you want the Fantastic Four back? Well, too bad. It's going to be, if you can have it back, but no one's going to want to do anything with it because look at the piece of crap that we made. That's kind of what I'm thinking.
I don't think they intentionally make movies to lose money, though, with the exception of the Corman one.
Yeah. No, I don't think it's an intentional thing. I think it's more a case of they've got the rights, they don't want Marvel to have them. And so
I think they don't know what to do with it.
Exactly right. They don't know I don't know what's happened to Mark Miller, supposedly being Fox's overlord, but he doesn't seem to be having much control over anything.
Well,
I don't know that he's trying to exercise any control. You know,
you think he's just taking the money and
out there
running?
That wouldn't surprise me.
I think he may be saying, "Yeah, this is good," you know, because he gets a little out there with some of his concepts. I think sometimes and.
He's cashed the check, so he's saying, "Yeah, this is good."
He's one of these creators who somehow, you know, occasionally seems to think he's above the people who are reading him, and will throw out shit and say, "If you don't understand it, it's because you're not smart enough." If you don't like it, you're not smart enough to understand it. I wasn't
smart enough to understand the subtleties of Civil War, obviously.
Well, thank God that it's the Marvel Cinematic Universe that's going to be doing that. So there's a good chance that it might not completely suck.
No, well, the Marvel Cinematic Universe cannot do the Civil War comic as it is, so I'm actually looking forward to it. Because, let's be honest, Marvel movies haven't put a foot wrong yet.
I fully anticipate that Captain America Civil War will have as much to do with the Mark Miller Civil War miniseries as Avengers Age of Ultron has to do with that miniseries.
Hmm. Yeah, and I will put money on you being right.
So, yeah, I think it's more just them lifting the title than it is any
real. Well, we've gone off on a tangent here. This is Back to the Bins.
No, you know, we're not. Back to the Bins isn't a movie podcast.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, but
this is Comics Monthly Monday.
Should we talk about an episode of Star Trek?
Sounds good.
Yeah, Why don't we jump into our episode before we go too much further afield?
Beyond the wormhole.
Being scanned by one of the satellites.
Shields up.
It's firing.
On the other side of the galaxy.
Hold on, we're going down.
A living hell is about to be discovered.
They could be 20 light years from here and we wouldn't have the first clue.
Where death has little meaning.
We're in the middle of a pretty ugly war.
Because no one ever dies.
We're all prisoners on this moon.
Major!
On the next episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, alright, first of all, I want to say thank you to Paul, who's going to take lead on the synopsis for this one, because my voice just isn't up to it. So thank you, Paul.
You're very welcome, and I want to say thank you to Wikipedia for writing this synopsis. Anyway, today we're here to talk about Battle Lions, the 13th episode of Season 1 of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which is directed by Paul Lynch, a story by Hilary Bader, teleplay by Richard Damis and Evan Carlos Summers. This originally aired on April 25th, 1993. And the story goes something like this. Kyle Paca, the spiritual leader of the Bajorans, comes aboard the station and requests a tour from Sisko. But during the tour, she subtly asks him to take her through the wormhole. Against his better judgment, he complies, and he, Bashir, Kira, and Opaka travel to the Gamma Quadrant. There, they receive a distress signal from an unknown source. Opaka tells Sisko not to hold back on her account, so the group goes to investigate. They find a planet with a network of satellites, one of which is malfunctioning. The runabout approaches the planet, and one of the satellites attacks it, forcing them to crash land. Opaka dies in the landing, which devastates Kira. However, her mourning is interrupted by a group of people called the Ennis. The Ennis explain that they are at war with a group called the Nol Ennis, who could attack at any minute. They take Sisko, Bashir, and Kira to a cave-like dwelling, and, as predicted, the Nol Ennis attack within minutes. Many of the Ennis are killed, fending off the attack. But after the battle, Kyle Paca enters the cave,
reincarnated by some form of extraterrestrial nanotechnology. The same technology revives the Ennis and Nolanis, but rather than a blessing, it is a curse. Both groups were sent to the planet as a punishment for centuries of conflict, doomed to die over and over. As Dax and O'Brien search the group, Sisko gets the Ennis and Nolanis to agree to meet in an effort to negotiate peace. Meanwhile, Kira must face her personal demons. Years of fighting the Cardassians on Bajor have taken their toll on her, and she has known nothing but violence since she was a child. However, while Kira is reconciling her problems, the Ennis and Nolanis refuse to fix theirs and resume fighting. The groups are revived once more and return to their respective camps. By this time, Bashir has discovered that the technology keeps those it revives, including Opaka, from leaving the planet. O'Brien and Dax find Sisko, and Opaka informs him that she will stay with the Ennis and Nolanis. She said it is time for them to begin their healing process, just as Kira has begun hers. Meanwhile, the Ennis and Nolanis resume fighting. Before O'Brien transports Sisko, Bashir, and Kira to the runabout, Opaka tells Sisko that her work is there now, but reassures him that their paths will cross again. That's the end of that episode. And I thought this one, to steal from my friend Andy, was all right. It's not bad. It's not a terrible episode, but I also don't think it's a great episode. I think that it's kind of a little bit of a missed opportunity. I think he could have really gone somewhere with Kai Opaka that they didn't. I thought the whole subplot with Kira was kind of a little... just too quickly moved into and on and beyond very, very fast. I thought there was a lot of chances for some seriously deep character moments that they didn't hit on. I thought that the story, you know, it almost seems like an episode of The Twilight Zone, or it almost seems like something you'd read in a Star Trek comic book. It wasn't bad. It was enjoyable watching. I didn't, you know, I wasn't looking at my watch to see when it was over. But it was okay. And, you know, to me, the best thing about this episode was when I saw Jonathan Banks walk onto the screen. And we could talk about him again in a moment, but I'm just curious as to what you guys thought about it.
You want to go first, Sean?
Go ahead, Andy.
I pretty much agree with everything Paul said. It's not a great episode, but it's not a bad one. I felt that Nana Visitor really overacted in this episode. Her performance when Kai Opaka dies is quite overwrought. Her performance in the teaser, where she learns what the Cardassians thought of her, is very large and broad. It's another Star Trek episode like Day of the Dove in the original series about the futility of war. It looks a little bit cheap. It looks like they just filmed it on the same set where they filmed Next Generation Cave Planet. And largely, the best thing about it is Jonathan Banks. It's not a bad one. It's not a great one by any means.
I have a little bit of a better opinion of it. I will admit, Kira in the beginning and her little outburst, you know, when she finds the Kai passed away, was a bit over the top. But her revelation of the fact that she felt that her entire life has been spent in fighting and working against the Cardassians, and that scene where she breaks down with the guy, I thought was a pretty good moment. I saw this as an example of Deep Space Nine trying to follow in the form of the original series. There's a lot of stuff in here. There's a lot of scientific stuff. There's a lot of stuff that the original series would tackle, specifically things like the alternative factor about people having to fight each other for all of eternity, the idea of the Kai having this vision of she needs to be the person to try and bring peace between these people who have been fighting all this time. The idea of let this be your last battlefield, where there's these two opposing races who've been fighting for all this time and have no idea what they're fighting for, but just continue fighting because that's all they know. I enjoyed the episode. I think, again, I've been more positive about a lot of this first season stuff than you guys. I'll admit it has some flaws, but overall I thought it was really pretty good.
I think it's interesting that we both went to it feels like an original series episode, because a lot of Deep Space, I think Deep Space Nine is the best Star Trek show since the original, and I think the reason for that is the characters are believable and they act believable in the most ridiculous of situations. I think my problem with this, the tone of this felt very next gen within an original series framework. So were perhaps the actors could possibly have been a little bit bigger in certain cases, like Avery Brooks, who sometimes appears somnambulant. He tones it down. And Nana Visitor kind of felt like she kind of had to up her game a bit because he was so somnambulant, which led to me being in the very unusual position of actually thinking she was overacting. And I normally think she's MVP in this show. I really do. So I think that's why those early scenes where they kind of hit me a bit more. I didn't remember Nana Visitor ever going that broad. I mean, the three of us can probably run off any number of times. Shatner goes broad, for example. But Visitor doesn't tend to do it. She always walks that line really well of Kira being quite a flamboyant and expressive character without ever going over the edge. And I felt she kind of went a little bit far in this one. Whereas everyone else was kind of playing it low-key, so it stuck out. I mean, I did like the teaser. I liked especially Sisko's reaction to what the Cardassians thought of her was genuinely amusing.
Yeah, she's not going to be happy.
No, she's not going to be pleased about this. But I think she went a little bit over the top with it. And yeah, Jonathan Banks is the best thing about it. The problem I had with it, how far does this not being able to die thing go? If you burn them, do they come back? If you cut off a few limbs, do they grow back? Is it like Highlander?
And it's if like you Wolverine.
It's Wolverine. Yeah,
you can grow him for a drop of blood. What?
Scarring. They have significant scarring.
Yeah. So that doesn't help. No, it doesn't. So that kind of confused me. I got what they were going for, that they're fighting because they don't know any differently. But if you can't die, at what point do you go, I've had enough of this shit, and just walk away? Go and live on another part of the planet somewhere.
Yeah, I'd go with that. And, you know, I didn't mind that. That almost seemed like, it was kind of like that was the excuse to have an episode, but then we're going to try and do some stuff. And like I said, my biggest criticism wasn't so much with that aspect of the story. It was more all the subplots that I just thought it was missed opportunities, because I just thought it could have been so much better. I mean, really? Kira's a war child. She's that's all she's known her whole life. She doesn't know that that's the way her focus is. Really? You have to tell her that, and she's like, "Oh yeah, really? I never realized that I've grown up a war my whole life." It just seemed to me like too convenient, too television episodic, and not real life enough. And I think, you know, to some extent, Andy, you hit it on the head that these are actors. And I'm not blaming Nana Visitor for this one, because I think she played with what she was given. But I think, you know, these are actors who make themselves generally, in the way they're written and the way they act, seem like they're real even when they're in an outrageous situation. And this, it just seemed too convenient to me. It just didn't play out in a way where, you know, she needed to realize, I mean, she knew she was always planning for war and being at war or whatever. But I think, you know, the whole, it would have been more subtle if she realized it in a social setting that she wasn't able to turn it off. But they put her on a planet that's in constant war, and she starts giving them some war strategy. Well, duh. You know, I mean, that just like seems so silly that you'd even criticize that. I don't know. It's just, I don't think it was bad. I'm sorry?
No, interestingly, I've just had a look on Memory Alpha while I was listening to you. Michael Piller says exactly what you just said, who's executive producer. He basically says, we had an excellent script that was not translated well to film. See, one of the things I like about the next generation, the Deep Space Nine crew, is they're not afraid to say when they don't think an episode works. And but Michael Piller essentially says
the acting was bad.
The direct quote is, "We had a show in the first season that I thought was a terrific script, but was not a terrific episode. Battle lines. It was a terrific concept, but the nature of the direction and the performances in that show made it feel operatic." Read between the lines of that. I think he's saying he doesn't think the acting was very good in this episode.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I do think she was over the top when the Kai died. I mean, I'm with you guys on that. She's somebody who's grown up in war and seen so many casualties. Now, as much as she, you know, found the Kai to be beloved and all, and how she idolized her, this is not a foreign situation to her, and she wouldn't be quite that dramatic, I don't think.
Well, I may have to disagree with you a little bit. This isn't like one of her brothers in arms or sisters in arms. This isn't someone that she's been fighting the war with. This is someone who's a spiritual leader. This would be like if, you know, for a Catholic, if you met the Pope and the Pope got killed, if you were a devout Catholic, or if, you know, if you want to take it to even further level, you know, go ahead and put in whatever religious icon in there. So it's not someone who she would be accustomed to seeing. It's not a parallel as if someone who was fighting with her and she expected that person to die. This was a person that was unexpected. So because this death was unexpected, I think her emotion would run a bit hotter than if it was just someone that she was fighting alongside, that, not to say that they are expendable, but they had a better chance of dying. So
I'm not saying she wouldn't feel it as deeply as that. I agree with you there. I just think as somebody who's lived with death her entire life, including her parents, I think she would be a little bit more outwardly stoic.
That she wouldn't express it in the manner that she did.
Yeah, I'm not saying she wouldn't feel it. I'm saying she would, you know, she'd almost have a little bit of a Vulcan kind of thing where, you know, you know, she would have to be much more subtle in her acting, where you would see that it was killing her inside, but she wouldn't be so openly expressive about it.
So if she did the sort of Bajoran chant, the sort of religious thing over there, but she wasn't sort of wailing and gnashing, it probably would have been a better representation of her character.
I think so. Maybe like tears running down, you know, like you could see the emotion, but just not as, you know, I don't know. It just reminds me of like the old funerals where, you know, you get the grandmother trying to throw themselves on the grave and stuff. And mm-hmm. That's not the war person. That's the grandmother. You know, I don't know. It just didn't strike me as, it struck me as over the top is what it did.
What did you think of Dax's scene with O'Brien, where Dax came across as incredibly stupid?
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. It was like it was like the writers were saying, hey, you know, when we started this show, we were focusing on O'Brien. He's still here. He's still good. even if we're gonna sacrifice Dax to make you think that, look how good he is.
Yeah, that's what it felt like. Dax is the science officer. She doesn't need stuff explaining to her.
You mean the whole needle in the haystack thing and the runabout?
Yeah.
I thought I didn't mind it. I thought it was, again, another callback to the sort of tropes that they kind of do in the original series, where they'll come up with this big scientific explanation. Scotty will give some sort of techno-babble type thing, and then someone will explain it with a clever aphorism. Oh, you know, we're going to, you know, rotate the Framenjatzers and are able to sonically disperse the atmosphere in like this. Oh, like finding a needle in a haystack. So
yeah, but the problem was they had O'Brien explaining it to Dax like she was the apprentice.
Mm-hmm.
She should not have been the repository for the exposition, because she should have understood what he was doing. You know, it would have been better if he had done it and she would have said, oh, what you're doing, you know, if she had been the one expositing at that point and saying, you know, that's a great idea, let's do this, or something, you know, where she even, you know, showed she totally understands everything he's doing, instead of saying, "Dah, what are you doing, O'Brien?"
No, I agree. That probably would have worked a lot better. Dax did seem a little underused, and I could imagine that it probably was the fact that they were still trying to figure out what exactly they wanted to do with Chief O'Brien.
You know, even I think if we were sitting in a room trying to write this episode right now, I think we would try and do it with something where, like, the combined intelligence of Dax and O'Brien came up with a solution, where the two of them started bouncing ideas off each other and then building on it, and that's how they did it. Mm-hmm. Not one of them just tells the other, we're doing this, you sit there and shut up.
You sit there and look pretty, little lady.
I saw a makeup case in the other room. Why don't you go make yourself pretty while I get them up here?
Yeah, it did have a bit of an old Fantastic Four comic vibe to it, didn't it? Oh, but O'Brien, what does it all mean? Well, I'll explain it to you, pretty girl. Come and sit upon my knee. But Dax didn't have much to do in this episode anyway, really. So maybe that line was in there just to justify a paycheck. I don't know.
I will say that there was a very, very quick Morn sighting. It was right at the beginning.
It was? I didn't see it.
It was at the beginning of the show. You really didn't see much of it. I've got it at about 1:55, a minute 55 into the show, and he walks behind Sisko and Bashir as they're following the Kai out of the airlock. It's a blink and you'll miss it thing, but a lot of these instances of Morn being in the show have been blink and you miss it, except for like the Nagus one where he played some really prominent roles.
Couple of interesting nuggets about this one. Hilary J. Bader wrote a number of Batman the Animated Series episodes, as well as contributing to the Batman the Animated Series comic, particularly The Lost Years, where she explained what happened between the animated series and the Batman Robin adventures, and then the third series where it teamed up with Superman, where Nightwing went off and stopped being Robin and all of that stuff. And this is the first time any Star Trek show actually gave us a definition of what the United Federation of Planets was, when Sisko explains that the Federation is made up of over 100 planets whose people have allied themselves for mutual scientific, cultural, and defensive benefits. And Picard would pretty much use that exact same quote in one of the Next Generation movies. I think it was Insurrection, but I can't remember.
I was happy when he threw in the word defensive on that. You know, let's not make it sound like we have no military purposes.
Oh, know? Yeah, I think Star Trek is very definitely the Navy in space. And for Roddenberry to actually go back on that when his pitch was Horatio Hornblower in space, that's how he told Shatner to play Kirk.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it doesn't make sense that you have these ships going out exploring in space with giant laser weapons and missiles that they can fire out that destroy ships. It's not... They aren't exploring. You know, the Enterprise was not a science vessel. It was a vessel that went exploring, but it definitely had significant defense capabilities.
And how many of their missions were to patrol the neutral zone and prevent the Romulans from doing such and such a thing?
Exactly, going to Balance of Terror. They had to go find out what was going on in the neutral zone and possibly take care of a possible Romulan incursion. So,
Errand of Mercy in the original show. A private little war in the original show.
Mm-hmm. So to say that Starfleet doesn't have or is not somewhat a militaristic organization is doing a disservice to it. Yes, they want to explore. Yes, they want to seek out new life, new civilizations. But they also realize that some of those new civilizations might not be happy that they're around and might take offense to them being around. So they need to be able to at least defend themselves. And if worse comes to worse, have to fight back.
Yeah, the Borg.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't spend a minute or two talking about Jonathan Banks, just because
he's brilliant. Actor.
Yeah, he really is. He's an actor that I always remembered as being kind of a bit player in Eddie Murphy movies, in 48 Hours and in Beverly Hills Cop.
He's in Gremlins as well.
Is he really? I didn't realize that.
He is the deputy policeman in Gremlins. I only spotted him when we watched Gremlins last Christmas, because it's one of those movies that's on every year, and we're watching it, and it's Angela who said, it's Mike from Breaking Bad.
Well, that's the breakout role, because when he came on as Mike in Breaking Bad, from the moment he walked in to the moment he walked onto the screen in his Mr. Wolf-like portrayal in that first episode from Pulp Fiction, He was brilliant from day one until he was done in the series, and he won my respect as a great actor. And when I saw him in this one, you know, I automatically just think, okay, this is going to step it up a level. And unfortunately, he really didn't have a lot to do in this episode as far as making the episode better, because they didn't really write enough in there for him. I think you could have had an actor with much less chops play the same role he played, sadly.
Now, unfortunately, I've just started watching Breaking Bad. I'm in just a couple episodes, so I haven't encountered this character yet. Is he? Does he come in within the first season?
I'm sorry, does he come in what?
Does he come in within the first season?
Isn't it end of the second, beginning of the third that Mike starts showing up?
I think it's the second season at some point. Probably about two-thirds of the way through the second season, I'm thinking.
Okay. Well, I'm looking to it.
But he's just, you know, again, I don't want to spoil any more than we already have, but he's brilliant. He's just a great character.
He's a character. He's a character that you know you shouldn't like, but because of Banks's performance, you actually do. And that's purely, I think, I mean, the writing in it is good anyway, but it's down to his performance as well.
I've gone on the record saying, in my opinion, and I've thought about this a long time, I think Breaking Bad is the finest dramatic television show I've ever watched.
Yeah, it is pretty good.
Yeah,
you need to watch them all back to back, though.
I've only seen the first couple of episodes so far, and I'm hooked. Anytime that I get an opportunity to sit down on Netflix and watch it, I'm putting on Breaking Bad, so I'm looking forward to getting into it.
Yeah. Well, I remember him from Otherworld. Do either of you remember Otherworld?
Never heard of it.
No, I don't.
A short-lived science fiction series in the early to mid-1980s about a family, I think, that are stranded on a parallel universe, and Jonathan Banks was the bad guy in Otherworld. But if you grew up watching TV in the 80s, he was in everything. He's in Hunter, he's in Hardcastle and McCormick, he's in the A-Team, he's in Hill Street Blues, he's in Simon and Simon, he's in Matt Houston, he was in Legman, which was a short-lived Margaret Collin private detective show, TJ Hooker, just scrolling through IMDb. So it's a shame it's took him this long to get him a role that has finally brought him some recognition. But he is the quintessential, it's that guy.
I pointed to his two performances in the two Eddie Murphy movies, because those are the two that I'm able to say, oh yeah, he's the guy who was in these movies. But I've seen him 100 times. I just couldn't tell you what the other movies are off the top of my head, or the other TV shows, as you mentioned. I guess he probably had more of a presence on TV shows, but he's definitely he's a callback to the character actors of the 70s who would show up on so many different shows.
Yeah, he's paid his dues.
Absolutely, and it's nice to see, like you said, see him getting his due at this point, because he certainly has earned it. Well, you guys have anything else specific on this one?
No, not really. I think we've covered a pretty good amount of it. You know, again, I seem to be the one who's either who seems to be a bit more positive on this. I'll go ahead and go with my final rating on this.
Well, hang on, before you give your rating, the only other point I just wanted to make, the other weakness to the episode that I just kind of, like, as I was watching it, just didn't sit right with me, was the thought that they would take somebody as important as Kyle Paca, and I know she encouraged them to do it, but that they would take her in through the wormhole without taking a little bit more in the way of precautions and making sure that you know, Starfleet or Bajor or other people were on board and knew what they were doing. And I'm not saying they would say, well, we can't take you because we don't have approval, but I think they would make sure that there was a little bit more just knowledge around that they were doing it, and I don't think Sisko would just take it on himself. Say, yeah, get them runabout ready, we're going through the wormhole. It just didn't sit right with me, and I think, again, it was a little bit in the way of, well, we want to get you through the wormhole, so we're not going to waste time doing it. So we're not going to have, you know, you take the proper steps. Whereas I think just a couple of throwaway lines might have been better, but then you wouldn't have the convenient plot of them on the planet waiting to be rescued, because that never would have happened.
Well, you know, I really can't argue with that. I mean, I guess I could say that the possibility of it being destined by the prophets or destined by the wormhole aliens to need to occur, that the Kai felt or had a vision that she had to be a peacekeeper among people who could not come to a peaceful negotiation, led her to this. But, you know, that's just trying to no prize away the storyline. And, you know, it...
Yeah. Also, I was thinking there would be tremendous fallout to Sisko. I don't care how they explain to everybody what happened. He went into the wormhole with the guy, and he came back without her. I don't care how he explains it. There's going to be people on Bajor who will hate him till the day he dies and will not, you know, will not put up with the fact that he's in charge of that station and would be, you know, on whatever sort of space phone to the Federation, say, I want this guy out of here, and I want him out of here now.
And, well, maybe that's something that they were planning on playing up throughout the rest of the season and through the rest of the series, that the conflict of Sisko taking their spiritual leader away and losing her would, you know, make people feel differently about him, because the Kai officially... At the beginning of the season, considered him to be the emissary, and so she promoted Sisko as this sort of visionary spiritual character for the Bajorans, and now there's that conflict that could be built up because of this happening. So,
yeah, now he took her away and killed her.
Yeah,
that's from their perspective, that's what happened.
Oops. Yeah. Do you think he just came back and said, "My bad, sorry"?
You know. In hindsight, that probably really wasn't such a good idea.
Not one of my best command decisions.
All right, so now that said, Sean, what's your rating?
Like I said, I'm a bit more positive on this. I'm going to give it a 3.5 bars of gold press latinum. I enjoyed the character moments a bit more than you guys did. I liked the callbacks that made it feel like it could have been a cousin to... any number of original series shows. I thought, yes, Visitor did overplay it, but I think she'll get a chance to get better roles. I'll agree, the idea of them taking the Kai away, this religious leader, this basically the Pope of Bajor, and essentially getting her killed is kind of a fault, but I guess I'm just, you know, I'm more prone to like these shows a bit, so I'm being... a little bit generous, so 3.5 for me.
Andy?
2.
Alright, that was terse.
Yeah, it's not bad, but it just looks cheap, and the acting brings it down a bit, and the character moments in this particular episode aren't enough to elevate it for me. That opinion will do a complete 180 on an upcoming episode.
It's gonna be interesting to hear, but I'm going on the premise that 3 is average, and you know, average not being bad, average being a fine show. So I'm seeing this one as, you know, it's entertaining, it's watchable. Like I said, I had no problem sitting there watching it, but I do think it just my biggest complaint about it is probably lost potential. There was so many moments in there that I think they could have just done so much more with, that they could have turned this into a brilliant episode if they had handled it correctly. And I'm going to go 2.5 on it. So the tiniest bit above Andy and a little bit below Sean. But, you know, it was entertaining and a lost opportunity.
Okay.
Well, seeing as we kind of went a little long on some of the, you know, the tangents and all, you want to save, we only have one piece of email, you want to save it for the next one?
Sure, we can do that. Yeah, if you guys would like to write in, once again, the email is listentotheprophets@gmail.com. thanks everyone for emailing in, and we'll get to emails next time out. In fact, Andy, if your voice can handle it, can you give us a next time?
Next time on an all new episode. No, I can't. Next time on an all new episode of Listen to the Prophets, we learn that Chief O'Brien is a god awful storyteller.
All right, see you all next time.
Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
All right, I'm gonna go.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled T-W-O-T-R-U-E-F-R-E-A-K-S. You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.